Douglas Fairbanks Jr. as Robin in the 20s, or Errol Flynn in the 30s. The Robin Hood to remember was a 1950s TV series starring the handsome and dashing Richard Greene.
You caught this fellow stealing a deer?
Yes. We're just carrying out the punishment. We're royal foresters.
Playing our kind and indignant hero, always sticking up for the underdog.
You're going to do that to him just for killing a deer.
Robin Hood, riding through the glen.
It was the very first British produced series to be successful in American television.
Author Paul Buell.
And it was the first British show to have a song to go along with it that became an actual hit in the U.S. and in Europe. And it ends, feared by the bad, loved by the good, Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.
Buell's book with Dave Wagner, Hide in Plain Sight, fills in the remarkable backstory of the program, which began with a radical entrepreneur named Hannah Weinstein. Weinstein had for years worked on left-leaning projects and campaigns. But as red-baiting and blacklisting rose in the U.S. in that period, she felt she might be more comfortable, shall we say, elsewhere. And she went overseas to produce for TV.
She and people working with her invented very, very low-cost ways of producing television. And one of the ones best known in television lore is having this one bush on wheels that they moved from one part of the set to another.
In Weinstein's new London production company, Sapphire Films, they also used another clever strategy. They worked with a stable of American writers who'd been accused of being Communist Party members and sympathizers and had been blacklisted in the U.S. Hiring them served a double purpose. It yielded inexpensive, high-quality scripts, and Weinstein was also providing desperately needed work for the writers, who were now completely unemployable in their own country under their own names.
I was her story editor on Robin Hood.
Albert Rubin was a friend of the producer, hired for his trustworthiness, if not his expertise in television.
I knew virtually nothing. It was a really sink or swim situation.
The main writers for the series were big-time movie writers, people like Ring Lardner Jr., who'd written Woman of the Year, Waldo Salt, screenwriter of The Flame and the Arrow, and much later the writer of Midnight Cowboy, and Ian Hunter, with a list of Hollywood credits a mile long. Now they were churning out Robin Hood episodes in secret under assumed names.
There we are, Robin, on its way to the tax coffers of Prince John.
Two of her writers were Academy Award winners, which, of course, she never could have acquired for anything near the salary she paid unless they'd been on the blacklist.
Robin Hood was work they could get in the days when one TV season meant 39 episodes. Story editor Rubin was in England, and the writers were in America, because in addition to being unemployable, some had had their passports revoked. So a season of necessarily secret communications began, and communication was different in 1956.
It all had to be done by snail mail.
Rubin's job was to write lengthy story summaries and mail them to the writer.
They always signed their communication Will Scarlet and Friar Tuck. And so I wrote to them as such, WS and FT.
Everything was passed through a third party, of course, to avoid any identification.
And then we'd get back the scripts.
The scripts, not surprisingly, reflected the values of their writers. Years later, Ring Lardner Jr. noted that the series gave him plenty of opportunities for oblique social comment on issues and institutions of Eisenhower-era America. And so it went.
I came to die here. Well, they can't find my body, so Sir Charles can't collect his tax.
One episode has an unfair property tax placed on the poor serfs.
Properly speaking, a serf owns nothing except his stomach. But we enjoy generous customs in this manner.
And Robin and his men work to restore justice to the underclass.
I'd like to see his face when he hears he isn't going to get my ox.
In another, loyalties and allegiances are tested as the rulers try to infiltrate the band of outlaws.
We must convince them that Robin has only one reason for being an outlaw, his own personal profit.
And then try to force them to betray Robin.
So you thought you'd make fools of us with your play acting.
Sound familiar?
My men could give you lessons in that. They saw through you from the first.
There's even an episode about a witch hunt.
We saw her in the woods last night in Mab's garden. She met a demon there.
It looked like Satan himself. I think I saw his horns.
Robin has to save a village woman who would be burned at the stake for conspiring with the devil.
Bring her to trial, I say.
Sometimes the episodes went further afield.
This ship is bringing Jewish refugees who've lost their homes, and they're here to find new ones.
I would say one of the most intriguing episodes for me was the episode treating anti-Semitism, which basically is Robin Hood defending a merchant banker in York and his daughter against being dispossessed by royalty.
Surely, my lord sheriff, the idea of a whole shipload of these people coming here with their foreign and English ways is as intolerable to you as it is to every right-thinking person.
In the context of 1954 and the Rosenbergs and so forth, pretty clear.
The Adventures of Robin Hood was an instant hit on both sides of the Atlantic. It ran for several seasons on CBS. And, of course, the more successful it became, the harder it was to conceal the identities of its band of merry blacklisted writers. Albert Rubin stood fast. Finally, after a long stretch, he was dispatched to New York for an important meeting with his writers. There they were, face to face, alias Friar Tuck, Will Scarlet, and the man who'd covered for them, their devoted story editor.
That was a big throw your arms around each other moment. It was an opportunity for us to do some laughing and raise a drink.
So here's to The Adventures of Robin Hood. You couldn't make this story up. A band of writers forced to be outlaws, writing in secret about a band of outlaws, with values and politics intact for 4 years in prime time. A bullseye, you might say.
Robin Hood.
For WNYC, I'm Sarah Fishko.
The greatest archers to a tavern on the green. They vowed to help the people of the king. They handled all the trouble on the English country scene and still found plenty of time to sing.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.